Hello, everyone, and welcome to JBFC Podcast, the official podcast of the Jacob Burns Film Center and Media Arts Lab. I'm your host, Andrew Jubin, and in this episode, you're going to hear a Q&A conducted by JBFC Board President Janet Maslin with filmmaker Adam Leon, the writer and director of the new film Gimme the Loot, out now from IFC. It was a really cool evening here at the Burns. This was back on March 7th. Adam came for a Q&A after a screening of the film, and it was a nice homecoming. Adam used to work in the programming department here at the Burns. He was our special events coordinator for a couple years, and he took off to go make this movie. And there's something really, really rewarding about being able to have someone you work with go out and do something creative, something that's a passion of theirs, and then be able to bring it back home and say, here, look what I did. And in the case of Adam, it was a huge film festival sensation. Took South by Southwest by storm, and it was just officially released last Friday by IFC. It's a very funny film. For those of you who have yet to see it, it's about two New York City graffiti artists. They are a tagging team. They decide to go on a quest to bomb the Citi Field Apple. And by bomb, of course, I mean tag the apple, spray paint the apple, draw some graffiti on the apple. And the story goes from there. It's a very small story. It's a very funny story. The characters are really well developed. It's a very, very fun movie. And Adam was here to talk about it with Janet. I will say no more. I will be back at the end of the Q&A. Here now is writer-director Adam Leon in conversation with Janet Maslin. Enjoy.
Please welcome internationally celebrated filmmaker and former Jacob Burns programmer Adam Leon.
Thank you very much. I require that introduction just before I go into a restaurant now.
So. I was just telling Adam I couldn't believe how much of his time we wasted sitting around in the diner going over lists of things that were coming up in the next season without realizing what was going on in his mind that was more interesting.
I was cursing a lot more in my mind, clearly.
Steve told me to ask you right away about the water tower scene.
I grew up in the city, and my friend, and that building is actually the building that I grew up in. So the interior of her apartment is the actress's actual apartment, but all the exterior stuff is the building I grew up in. My friend who lived down the block, he would swim in his water tower, I used to tell him, if you drown, we're never going to know. Like, we're never going to find out. So I really wanted to do that. I thought it was a sort of a really unique New York touch. I mean, part of the idea of the movie was to kind of show that there was a New York that existed still now, currently, that had a little bit of an edge to it and a little bit of a grit to it, you know, and a lot of the New York that I've been seeing in movies and TV are sort of the mollification of New York. And so I felt like that fit into the idea of the movie that we were doing. And I also really like the idea that the kind of the white girl who isn't the graffiti artist is also a physical presence. But then when I cast her, the first time I was interviewing with her, I asked her what her interests were, and she said, urban climbing. And I was like, what does that mean? And she was like, you know, climbing barges and water towers. And I remember thinking, I really, really hope this girl can act. I don't know who else we're going to convince to do that. But yeah, we did that. That was the second day of filming. And it was extremely nerve-wracking and irresponsible of us.
Did you need a permit to get up there?
I mean, we probably needed more than that. But we definitely lied a lot about that. And it was a moment where it's like, if this goes wrong, like, we're not going to Cannes with this movie. Like, I'm not making movies anymore. I hope that I never would have to do something like that again. But I really thought I had seen her do it, and I felt really comfortable with her, and she was very, very comfortable and thought we were hilarious for how concerned we were about it. But we were really, really nervous. And the she only went in once, and so we rehearsed all morning. I remember telling Tashi and Ty, you better hit your mark at the end of this shot, because we're not having her do this again. So she climbed it, you know, a few more times for the other shot. But
and what is happening between the three of them when they're looking at each other there?
Well, what do you think is happening between the three? I was very, one of the ideas I was really interested in is exploring these teenage characters that are real type A personalities, that really sort of embody a teenage spirit of being very cocky and comfortable with themselves, but that there's key moments throughout the movie where when they're confronted with something that really is, and in New York, you know, there's all these paths that cross, but when you're confronted with something that really is a little bit out of their world or something that they're not quite as comfortable with, that they don't, that they're kind of caught and they're brought down a little bit. And I think that that's what's going on there. I think that you have three characters that are deers in headlights, and they don't kind of realize that they're afraid of each other at that point.
When I first met you, I think you might have still been in school, and your major was very interesting. Can you talk about what you majored in, really?
Yeah, okay. Let's go there. I majored in African American studies. I feel...
And you were the only white guy in the department.
I was. You know, I feel that... I did that. That's true. I went to college. I went to this public school in New York City that was very diverse, very interesting sort of incubator. And I went to college expecting that it was going to be like that times 10, because it was going to be this international place. And I was really disappointed with the classes. And I felt that a lot of the kids were brown-nosing, and that there was almost this kind of tacit agreement between the professors and the students of, like, I'm here to write my books, and you're here to get a degree so you can go get a job at Goldman Sachs, and we're not going to challenge each other, and that's what it's going to be. And I went, started in a general requirement class, I took a class in African American studies, and it really wasn't like that at all. And the more classes like that I took, the more I felt challenged. I felt people really honest and I don't know, more alive in those classes. I majored in African American studies. I made a movie with two African American leads in it. One could think that there's a fetishization going on there. I don't think that's the case. I think that the way that this story happened was really organic. I knew Ty, who's the lead actor, and I really wanted to work with him, and I think it developed from there.
Who's the actress? She's wonderful.
Sorry, it's my Rubio moment. The actress is Tashiana Washington. I will be filibustering later as well. Is Tashiana Washington. So I wrote the role for Ty. I knew him. I developed it with him. And
how did you know him?
I co-directed a short film, and my casting director had found him in a skate park and brought him in. I really liked him. Yeah. And I liked working with him. He was 15 when we did the short. He was really young and precocious and also really annoying.
Is this killer? That
this, yeah. And but then a year later, when it started to go to festivals, I took him to right when I started here. Actually, I like took the job, and I was like, actually, I have to take a week off. Like after, and I went to Nantucket with the film, and he went with me. And that weekend, I was like, God, this kid is really reminds me of myself when I was a kid, and I would like to work with him again. So it developed from there. So we looked at one person for that role, but we looked at over 500 girls for Sophia. It's a tough role because you have to have a face that holds the screen. She's quite, quite beautiful. She's very, very different than Sophia. She's this really glamorous, soft-spoken. She doesn't curse. Gorgeous, gorgeous bombshell of a girl.
Had she acted a lot before?
She's not a lot, but she'd done modeling, and she's in like the Jennifer Lopez Kia commercial as a dancer and things like that. So she hadn't really gotten a substantial role. But we did so much street casting. I felt like I knew every girl in New York City. We were bringing them in every weekend, and it's this tough combination where you have to have a face that can hold the screen. She's particularly beautiful. It doesn't have to be that beautiful. But you have to be really tough, But you also have to be able to be vulnerable and have some sort of sense of comic timing. And it was hard. We had some false starts but she walked in and she was amazing.
When you mentioned going to Nantucket, we skipped the fact that you won a big award there.
I did. We won the best short film at Nantucket. Yeah, that was fun, and it was a really fun experience to go through with Ty. And we had a great weekend. And I really think that weekend kind of solidified in my mind that I wanted to do something with him. And I felt like I didn't think I could raise $1 million to make a movie.
Is that what it wound up costing?
No. Our production budget was $65,000, and so I felt
10,
like
10,000 of which went to one song.
That's, don't tweet that, but that's true. The last song is our most expensive purchase in the movie. Well, the production budget was $65,000. I should say the entire budget total is about $170,000. I would say when you do like legal fees and music clearances and stuff like that. But you sort of have to grab what you. I felt like this story fit very well with the idea of that it should be a low budget film. Like, I think if this movie works, it works in part because of how we told it, and that it would be worse with $5 million.
Yeah.
And so that was exciting for me. That felt like, okay, this is a good match. I feel like I could raise $100,000. I feel like this is a story that you should tell for $100,000. And then you kind of say, like, what do I have? And I have Ty. He's okay. I have a lead actor. That's good. Like, what else? I wrote a lot. Anybody you see in the movie that's over 22 is somebody I knew. Before, so including the guy with tattoos on his face, like so all those roles were written for people I knew, and then it was just about going out and finding the kids.
Who were those guys sitting in the park rapping?
You know, that's
'cause that's a great moment.
Thank you. Well, that's a good sort of, I think. So both in terms of casting and production, casting, there's kind of three levels of casting. There was people I wrote roles for, then there's people we went out and casted during pre-production, and then we would, the idea was always prepare as much as possible and then go out there and shoot it and know that everything was going to go wrong. But because we had the preparation, because we had this team of people behind that really was on the same page, we could embrace that. And so that was a day where we put out a call to people who had come into audition to Ty, get all your friends to show up. And we just sort of went out to like 50 people expecting 10 to 20 to show up, and 10 or 20 to like 15 showed up, and we just had them play basketball. And we were on lunch.
They didn't show up together, or you just put them together?
Yeah. I mean, three of them showed up together. Like, the kid who sort of gets into it with Caps, you know, he was up for that role, and we knew him. I actually met him. It's a good story. I met that kid, the sort of cocky basketball player kid, on a train from Jacob Burns back into the city after work.
Thank goodness.
The girl that he was with, I thought could be great for Sophia, and I went up to her. And it's a little tricky to go up to these girls. I was going up to girls on the street all the time being like, I want to put you in my movie. And so I go up like, hey, here's my casting director and my producer's cards. They're women. You can look us up. We're real. And this girl was like, she didn't want to have it at all. I was like, hey, I don't know if you're interested. I'm not. Exactly. But Hassan was like, I am interested. And I think he lives around here. So some of them we knew, some of them just showed up that day. And then we were on lunch, and my producer comes running up to me and he's like, you got to see what's going on. And they were just doing that. And so our DP, our cinematographer, was somewhere, I don't know. And we just took the assistant camera guy and we were like, start rolling, and we rolled on it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was really about, but I don't think that we could have had that, I don't think we could have been open to those type of things if, sometimes people ask us, did we improv this movie? And it's, to me, that's ridiculous. Like, we couldn't have improv this movie. We did tons of rehearsal. We we needed to really know what we needed to get every day and all sort of know what movie we were making to be able to have those moments. So when a guy comes up to us, we're shooting the scene with the bodega bouncer, and a guy comes up to us and says, do you want somebody who looks like Snoop Dogg to be in your movie? And I'm like, I do. Would like that very much. And so he's the bodega bouncer in the movie.
Why graffiti? What was it about that that drew you?
I thought that I really wanted to tell a story that was, I knew these kids growing up, and I knew these kids from making the short film. And I felt that I was very interested in these kids who are working class kids who have these tough backgrounds, but aren't necessarily miserable people. And I hadn't been seeing that story told that much. So that was kind of the idea. Let's do something that's fun set in this world. And I felt graffiti was a great jumping off point for that, because I was working with some graffiti writers and I started to sort of see them as these, and I have ambivalent feelings about graffiti, but
have you ever spray painted anything in the middle of the night?
I had some friends that were graffiti writers growing up, two of my best friends, and I sort of did it for a week, but I'm really bad at drawing, and I just couldn't do it. I really have very mixed feelings about graffiti. And so now people think I'm like the graffiti guy, and they give me every graffiti coffee table book, and I'm like, thank you, yeah. But I was fascinated by the culture, and I was really fascinated by these kids who take these incredible chances for really no monetary gain, absolutely no monetary gain, and this culture where you have to climb scale buildings and jump over roofs and run from the police and get into these rivalries and start to think of them as kind of really low rent, real life action stars. And I wanted to tell an adventure, exciting movie in New York, and so I thought that that would be a good jumping off point.
Given the kind of budget you had and the kind of permits you had from the city and all that, was there ever any chance you were going to get into the stadium and get to the Apple?
No. That was never an idea. I think I had written other scripts before, and I think the first script that I wrote, I very purposefully wrote completely for myself. So it would be a $30 million movie that I would like. It was not to get made. It was to go through that process. By the time I wrote this script, I was like, I gotta get out of the Jacob Burns. No. I was like, I really was very conscious of production elements. So it's so much of its daytime exteriors. And that's because we could just put a camera down, take advantage of shooting wide, the production value of New York City, and we don't need lights. You don't really need permits to do that kind of stuff. We don't need to pay location fees. So I was very conscious of production while I was writing the script, which was new for me to do. And so that was never crossed my mind. But I also wanted to tell this story where the audience was having fun, but things kept going wrong for the characters. But ultimately, the characters, I think if Malcolm and Sophia, when they look back on these 2 days, in a month from now, in a year from now, that these will be the best 2 days of their summer. And so that was kind of the idea. You don't seem to agree with that.
No, I'm debating whether I can ask you.
Go for it. Let's do it. Well, it's snowy.
Did you imagine they were going to wind up together?
I was very interested in this idea of a relationship between teenage boy and a teenage girl, where I think when you're 17 years old, for the most part, and you're dating somebody, you're not dating them in 3 months. And I wanted to tell this relationship about something that was really built on love but wasn't sexual. And when you have those kinds of relationships, I don't know if any of you guys have, but I think that sometimes maybe somebody has a crush on one week, and maybe 3 weeks later the other has a crush on the other, and you're always sort of thinking maybe it would happen, maybe it wouldn't. Whether or not like condoms are going to come out for them, I don't really want to go there in my mind. But I think that they do love each other very much. So I don't know. I feel it's sort of for other people to. I purposely didn't resolve that.
Okay.
But sometimes people are like, I'm so disappointed they didn't kiss at the end of the movie. And I'm like, was anybody disappointed by that? No, good. I'm just like, well, besides the fact that I don't think the movie should go there, they're they smell bad. They're dirty. They're tired. They've been out for a long time. They're not feeling sexy at all, you know, so.
Did you have any expectation that this film was going to have the impact that it did?
No.
Or even that it would get into any festivals or any of that?
We believed in the film very much. We wouldn't have made it if we didn't. We thought we had something good. We thought that we had a story to tell that was going to be told in a way that hadn't been told before. And we wouldn't have set out to do it if we didn't think it could find an audience. We didn't know what that audience would be. We hoped we would get distribution, but we really were not planning on that. We thought in the back of our heads as a goal, we can't control this, but we thought it would be a great fit for the South by Southwest Film Festival. That was something that we had talked about. And so we were extremely excited when we got in. And we really thought that that was the right fit for the movie. But for then what happened, and we were overwhelmed, but I think, again, we believed in the project, so I don't want to be false. I don't think that we were jumping up and down, and we went and got shots, and we were, like, so excited. But I don't think we were, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, we were trying to make something that could fit into that world. And working at Jacob Burns, actually, was very instructive to me, because I had the idea for the movie. I knew I wanted to do this, but I would go. Jacob Burns sent me to Sundance, to Toronto, and you go and you watch 5 or 6 movies a day to see what movies we should bring here. And I saw this not only for myself, but from all the people who go through that experience, and that's not just programmers, that's distributors as well. There's nothing like, you're deciding between 3 movies, and or you're deciding between 2 movies, and one of them is 80 minutes and fun, and the other is like a 3-hour rape doc, and you go to the 80, like, you, they play really well at festivals. So that idea was encouraging. I was very encouraged when I would go to Sundance in Toronto and see that. I was like, I think I am on a good track here. So, yes, I mean, I think we were hopeful that we would go to something like South by Southwest. We did not expect to get distribution. We're opening in 30 cities around the country. We went to the Cannes Film Festival. I mean, that's bonkers. We never expected that at all.
What did they ask when it got to France? They always ask very strange questions.
They do, you're right.
What did they make of your film?
My favorite question wasn't a question. My favorite question was, your film is political. Explain. I was like, is it? And they're like, yes. We went into Cannes. We were an official selection of the Cannes Film Festival. There's about 35 movies that do that.
Were you in a certain regard, yeah.
We went in saying, they can't take this away from us. We got this. It's not that we don't care how people react, but if they hate the movie, it doesn't matter. We went in with so low expectations, or so, like, we weren't nervous. But we've been so, I think we've been really blessed and really lucky, and it's been so much fun to take this movie around the world, because it's gone around the world, and audiences seem to generally react very positively to it. I think that even though it's a very hometown type of movie, and it's about a couple of very specific cultures, I think that people are able to grab on to something that connects to them about their youth, and there's some universal themes. So it particularly played well in Cannes. I think Cannes and New York City have been the best places that it's played.
You worked for Woody Allen for a while.
I did.
Did you pick up anything from him about locations and getting a sense of a city? Because you get a wonderful sense of New York and a variety.
I think I picked up more about that from watching his movies than from working on his movies. I think that working on set on his movies, just seeing how production works in New York, mm-hmm. The nuts and bolts was very instructive. I think the most instructive thing, though, was working in the editing room. I was an intern in the editing room, and seeing how he put together the movie, and seeing a kind of, you know, I think he would be loath to admit it, but how much focus is put on the audience once you get to the editing room, really throughout the process, but that there's just no sentimentality for what you've shot. There's no sentimentality for, like, how hard. The most expensive day of shooting, the most complicated shot that we did in the movie isn't in the movie. And people are like, wow, that's really good that you didn't put, you didn't force that into the movie. And I'm like, I couldn't even... That comes from Woody, though, seeing, like, I remember asking him once, he cut this really beautiful shot from a movie, and I said, that shot's beautiful, and he said, but it's not helping the story in any way, and what do I got to do to show, I got to show people I can do a beautiful shot? Like, what do I have to prove? That's not why people are going to go see my movies, to say, like, that guy knows how to do a slow zoom, you know. It's so that was very, very instructive, and also just the diligence that he took in the editing room. I think a lot of people take their foot off the gas once they get into the editing room because the pressures of production aren't on them. You know, you don't have to worry about the weather, and you don't have to worry about all the elements. But that he kept that going. We're going to go in every morning. We're going to move this thing along, and so. I think that those were the biggest lessons I got from.
What's the shot you couldn't use?
Well, we actually reshot it. The original opening was of them doing graffiti and it getting buffed was this super complicated shot where you sort of start on an elevated train and you go down to them and they're doing graffiti and you zoom in and then they get scared off of the roof and they run through a window and then you pan and you see it's the white kids and they come into the frame and they buff the piece and then you like we pan over here and you zoom down to the street and they're down on the street and I was very proud of myself. It was quite a complicated effort, but you couldn't ever see their faces, and what it felt like was that a filmmaker was showing off. And that it didn't feel like, here are these two characters. The movie for me was always, it's not about the Metz apple. Who cares about the Metz apple? It's not, this is a movie about two kids losing their baby. And so you can just immediately grab onto that. So it always had to be about, you want to go on this adventure with Malcolm and Sophia. Yeah, there's this thing about $500 in an apple, but you want to be in this world and you want to go on an adventure with these people. And so that shot was really doing us a disservice because I think it wasn't telling the audience that, A, you're in good hands, we're not going to screw around, and B, like, these are these people, this is why this is important to them.
Just one more New York question. How did you get all those long running scenes? You didn't have a lot of fancy equipment.
No. So I think you mean the ones where we're like going across the street.
While you're following.
Yeah.
While the two women are running.
We had a van that we were using, an equipment van. We had two cars, equipment van and a passenger van. And we just took the equipment van, we opened the side of the door, and we just like taped the camera and like with ropes and then just shot it and like, had people like running out and blocking cars and stuff, and so we just did it. Yeah.
Did you cut like whenever there was a traffic light?
We just had to like go around in a loop, you know, for an hour because it was always very, really hard to time it. And then we, you know, I didn't want to only get it once, so we got it like three times. And you know, it took my team sitting there and making sure that it worked.
All right, here you are. An award-winning filmmaker with a great credit. Jonathan Demme is going to present this film, which makes total sense because the music is so great and the style is so great. And
that happened because we set up a screening for him here. So,
anyway, this is going to lead a lot of people to a lot of different places. Have either of the actors gotten other work because of this film?
Not yet in a substantial way. I think that.
She will, for sure.
I'm very hopeful. I think that sometimes, and it's a real compliment to the movie, but it's not, I think, a compliment to them as much, is that people think I found them. Like, I found Malcolm and Sophia. And these kids could not be more different. They grew up in New York City. They know Malcolm and Sophia, and they were able to draw on that. But they're very, very talented young actors. He's this bow tie wearing, really like elegant man, new man kind of thing. Like no sneakers, you know, or anything like that. And she, as I said, is this very, very glamorous girl. So I'm hoping that when the movie comes out, people will recognize them more. Some people have told me that that's usually how it works. There's a lot of attention on the director in the festival circuit, and then once the movie comes out, it shifts a little bit to the actor and the actress. I'm really hoping that's the case.
Well, what's going to happen to the director?
Well, I hope that I can keep doing this. I loved doing this so much. It's a crazy moment for me right now because the movie comes out here on March 22nd. It comes out at the March 29th. It comes out at the IFC Center on the 22nd, and it's all I've wanted ever, like since I was a little kid. And making the movie just made me want to do it again more. I loved making it so much. So I'm working on stuff.
You did this.
It's called a dodge. I just dodged Janet Maslin's question. Don't tell anybody.
You work with total freedom to do whatever you want at this time.
Right.
People are going to start offering you other kinds of jobs. Yes. where things will be bigger and you'll be more accountable and you know what happens. Do you want to stay independent this way or are you? What are you going to be doing in 5 years? Do you think?
Well, I mean, again, hopefully making movies.
But what kind of movies?
Right. Just like a little quick aside about what you're saying in terms of total freedom on the movie. I mean, it's very, very much true, and I'm really appreciative of that. I'm the head of the company. Like, I'm very much in charge of the entire operation, and that's an extremely rare freedom. Somebody read the script really early on, a producer, and they said, you're not going to want to hear this, but you should change the characters from being African-American to white because it makes it more marketable. And I said, we're making the movie for $100,000. The advantage is that we can kind of do whatever we want. You know, I don't want to do whatever I want in terms of the audience. I want the audience to really care about these characters and like the movie, but we can make it how we want to make it. To your specific question, I think that, and this may sound a little bit cliche or stock, but I'm really interested in the relationship between the audience, between the filmmakers, the story and the audience. And so, and that separation, that in some ways is why we chose the music that we chose, that there is a separation between the people who are telling the story and the story being told, and how that's interacting with the audience. I want to make movies that have a chance to be some audience, whatever that audience is, their favorite movie of the year. Just feel like they hit it out of the park. And that can be on a really big scale.
It's a great thing to say. I've never, ever heard anybody say that.
Really? Thank you. I say it in the LA meetings all the time. They seem to like it. But that can be... I mean, I've used this example too. Maybe this, there's a movie that came out last year called Chronicle. I don't know if any of you guys saw it. But it's a teen found footage movie. I think it's really, really good. And then there was a movie that came out last year that's called Amour. Is not a teen found footage movie. I loved both of those movies very, very much. One is for 15-year-old boys, and one is for you guys. But it is for an art house audience, you know. And so, for me, I don't know if I would have made exactly either of those movies. I would be so lucky to make them more. But for me, I just... both those movies hit it out of the park. And so I'm really interested in stories that have the potential to do that. So I'm making a movie with the studio is such a different set of challenges than it is making this kind of movie. But I am open to that. I'm interested in that. But it has to feel right. And I think you have to be on the same page with the people who you're making the movie with.
Do we have time for two questions?
Two questions.
Okay, two questions.
I am the same age as Malcolm and most of the people in the movie, and I found that the dialogue was like surprisingly relatable. I could probably count on just one hand how many movies are able to do that. So I was just wondering how much of the dialogue was drawn from conversations you've had or just your real life.
It's drawn from a lot of different elements. It was, in some ways, there was a lot of research. This sounds, sometimes people laugh at this, but when you go into the subway in New York, there'll be these, you know, young kids who come on the subway and they'll be really boisterous and loud. People like move to the other end of the car. Once I had the idea to start to work on this movie, I would like pretend I had my headphones on and just listen in on their conversations. A lot of it comes from knowing, from growing up in the city, but also, you know, knowing Ty who plays Malcolm. And whether it was the graffiti, the locations, the language, it was really important for us that everything was authentic, because I felt that if you didn't feel the language was authentic, or if a graffiti writer didn't feel that the graffiti was authentic, that people who weren't graffiti writers or people who weren't young can still tell, that it doesn't pass a certain smell test. And so, like the same approach we had with the graffiti, where I'm not a graffiti expert, but we brought in a legendary graffiti writer who came in every week and did graffiti class, not only teaching them how to do the art itself, but also teaching them the language and the culture and the mindset of a graffiti writer. We took that approach in terms of the language as well. And so that came from the entire team of people who were making the movie, people that we knew, giving them the script, sort of saying, you know, well, kids wouldn't say this now anymore. Like, that was kind of the process.
Did you subtitle it for France?
Well, yeah, we definitely subtitled it for France. It's been subtitled on a bunch of different
countries. Read the subtitles?
It was definitely a challenge because I also wanted to... It's hard for the people who are subtitling to buy into this argument, but I was like, it's really important for an audience to understand what's going on, but I would imagine that... I don't always understand what's being said. It's okay if you don't understand every single word. That's sort of what the movie is. They're speaking in not only a very youthful slang, but they're also a cultural slang of graffiti. So, you know, they're calling people toys and stuff. And so it's just, and that's a very much a graffiti term. And so trying to strike that balance was difficult, but I don't know if it's good or not. I don't speak French.
Last person.
That was my question. But when you're on set, this might sound like a foolish question, but what scares you the most when you're on set?
Not much, I would say. I don't know. I don't want to answer that sort of in a... That's not a foolish question. It's a really good question. I'm going to give you a foolish answer, I think. Once you're making the movie, it moves really fast, and I don't think you have time for that. It's just a constant stream of quick decision making, and I was very lucky on this movie. I've not always had this luck, but I was really lucky on this movie to have an incredibly supportive team, and there was nobody who was trying to, you know, there's no machinations going on. I just think. There's no time for that. You just can't. You can't be afraid of anything. So I think afterwards, it's like, I can't believe we just did that water tower scene. That was insane. But when you're doing it, it's about getting the shot. And that's it. I hope that's an okay answer.
Last question for me.
Okay, thank you. You're going to bail me out. Thank you.
Will you promise here now that whatever you do from now on forever, you'll come back here and talk about it?
It would be my pleasure. I mean, it's hard for me to sort of overstate how important working here was in terms of my life as a whole, but really giving me the encouragement to go out and make this movie. When I came, this is going to sound platitudish and sort of, but I feel like I do really want to express this. When Brian and Steve hired me to come here, I told them I wanted to go and do this, and they said, that's great. And they were incredibly supportive of me throughout the entire time, and Dominic and everybody. And that's an amazing feeling. And I also think that what this place is all about in so many ways, but that idea of the film as a collaborative art, the importance of story, these are things that Steve and you talk about so much. I really take those things to heart. And so not only my personal experience here, but the mission of this place, I think, is amazing. I said it before in the intro, you guys are incredibly lucky. You should see Ginger and Rosa, too, with Sally Potter. It's going to be a great event.
Can I take that as a yes?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
No matter what, I would do anything for you guys, always. You've done so much for us. And thank you guys for showing up on this crazy night. So.
We'll hold you to it.
Thank you.
Gimme the Loot opens this Friday, March 29th at the Burns. For showtime and ticket availability, you can, of course, check out our website, www.burnsfilmcenter.org. While you're there, you can check out any other special event information, membership information, or education information you might be looking for. If you have any questions, comments, concerns for me, I can be reached at podcast@burnsfilmcenter.org. Check out our website for all past episodes of the show. That's www.podcast.burnsfilmcenter.org. If you subscribe to the show in iTunes, please rate and review there. It increases the profile of the show in the iTunes store, and we would greatly appreciate it. That's going to do it for this week's episode. Until next time, I'm Andrew Jupin, and you've been listening to JBFC Podcast.